All right, we're live. No intro. Let's just
live
go. Let's just do
from
it cold.
The Ken and Valerie
or
Baker
not.
Studio
there it is.
At WHYY.
Oh, what a way to start
is
on this
Studio
Thursday.
Studio 2.
Welcome.
Hey,
Avi. Welcome.
I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. Is it just my voice now? That's great. Thursday, August 13th. Welcome to the show.
I'm Kevin McCrory in for Cherry Gregg.
And maybe Ed Cunningham will bop back in. You never know.
You never know around here. So
let's talk about the future we have and the future that was promised. So in a lot of ways, Kevin, the computer age has lived up to the hype. I mean, computers, the internet have totally changed the way that we transmit and receive information.
Sure.
I mean, revolutionized it. But when you go back and look at people's prognostications about the future from 20, 30, 40, 100 years ago, the one thing that hasn't really manifested is computers in the physical world. Not that there are none, but everyone thought, basically, we're going to have robots.
Right. Where are the jetpacks? Where are the hovercrafts? Where are the robots?
Exactly. Computerization in the physical world. It just hasn't quite materialized for many reasons. We're going to get into this hour. But we may be on the precipice of breaking through. There are a lot of companies. You got to be careful with these companies because sometimes it's spin and sometimes it's hype. But there's a lot of companies promising that humanoid robots are coming. Humanoid robots in the workplace. Humanoid robots around your house, doing your dishes, your laundry, etc.
Yeah.
So today on the show, we're going to get futuristic and weird. We're going to talk about how real this possibility is. And if it is real, what does the future of robot coexistence look like? Are you excited for this conversation,
Kevin? I'm excited for the conversation, not excited for the prospect of a robot in my house. No.
Yeah, you're a salt of the earth guy. I can tell. So we'd love to hear from you. Would you want a robot to help do chores at home? Are you optimistic, looking forward to this future? Are you pessimistic, fearing this future? 888-477-9499, studio 2 at WHYY.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat. If you're a robot, please call in 888-477-9499.
And we talk about friction maxing on the show, Avi. There's something beautiful you get from scrubbing the grease out of those dishes yourself. Maybe.
You really like scrubbing the grease. Do you scrub the grease in your house?
I do.
You do?
We share the responsibility.
Okay. I just want to make sure because we can romanticize scrubbing the grease if we're not scrubbing the grease. Anyways, it's also Thursday. It's DJ of the day. So if you have a song about this topic in your head right now, send it in to EP Kevin at studio2 at whyy.org. We will end the show with a song picked by one of you. You will be our DJ of the day. You have to get your submissions in by 12:30, by the way, studio2 at whyy.org. We rarely have the judge with us on
air.
Are there any songs you'd like to rule out?
Well, I would say just based on your hatred of Kraftwerk, there's not going to be Kraftwerk.
No Kraftwerk this week. There is one song, I won't say it, that's very on the nose. We'll see if that you pick that one. I don't know.
Right.
It's up to you.
Let's see.
But first, a trio of local news stories. And we start with a very serious story. Kevin, take us away.
Yeah, we got a major update in this Alani House of Horrors case. Police now say they believe at least two women who had been on the missing persons list were killed in this home. That's what they believe. Officials identified the women as Maribel Freses, who was 27 when she went missing in 2018, and Gabrielle Amarando, who was 22 when she was last seen in 2012. If you haven't been following this story, it's extremely grim, disturbing. It centers on this decrepit house in Alani, where 44-year-old Eugene Horsch had lived with his late father, Raymond Horsch. And here's what we know. Raymond was a pornographer who made violent films and was known to offer drugs, cash, shelter to women who were struggling with addiction in exchange for these nude shoots. The investigation into this father and son and this house started in June, after Eugene, that's the son, had a chance encounter with law enforcement officials actually right here near us on Independence Mall that ended up with them searching his car and finding illegal weapons, counterfeit badges, other disturbing things that led them to this house. And police have now been searching the house for months, have uncovered evidence that includes 5 urns of cremated remains, 20,000 unknown containers of chemicals, 50 hard drives that hold more than 600,000 images and 70,000 videos. And through that search, police found footage of the two women we mentioned at the top of this story, and that in this footage, they believe it shows them both dead and alive. and many more deaths could be linked to this house. Police say that they've interviewed sources who knew Eugene Horsch, and he bragged about killing people and melting their bodies with chemicals. One of the trips here, though, is Eugene has not yet been charged with murder, as police have not yet found physical evidence linking him to the alleged crimes. And the story that came out late yesterday, very good reporting by media outlets across the city, including the Philadelphia Inquirer, who spoke to the victim's family members, who opened up about how the latest revelations here confirmed their worst fears. And both of these women we mentioned grew up in Bucks County, fell into opioid addiction, and, you know, just were missing for years until we got this detail yesterday.
Yeah, horrifying, disturbing, and I would second what you said about the Philadelphia Inquirer's reporting on this. It's been essential, and we'll be looking for the next in this case. A very different law enforcement story now. So you might have seen there are some photos circulating online showing camera crews following SEPTA transit police around like subway trains and subway stations, and you might be wondering why they're doing this. Well, according to SEPTA, this is part of an untitled documentary series that will be broadcast on the cable channel A&E next year. So basically, it sounds like there's going to be a reality show about SEPTA cops. The Transit Authority says this series will allow the audience to, quote, get to know some of the men and women of SEPTA's 200-plus strong police force as they face the challenges of patrolling the sixth largest transit system in the country. They say filming will continue through October. So I guess next year, look for this reality show coming out on cable about transit police in Philadelphia. I had not heard anything about this until recently.
Hadn't heard about it either. Yeah, I haven't seen the crews. I'm hopeful that this crew and this production company will take this, you know, job seriously and do a piece.
Because you never know with cable reality shows.
Cable reality show, my gut instinct doesn't feel good. But you never know. But hopefully they come up with something that, you know, shows what it means to actually do the job of a Philadelphia transit cop, and also shows what it means to ride transit. And maybe there's a interesting just kind of documentary of life in Philadelphia in 2026 that comes out of this. But hopefully they don't, you know, sensationalize it and do it the worst way.
By the way, A&E, same channel that aired Parking Wars. You remember Parking Wars?
I do.
That was a reality show about PPA officers. It ran from 2008 to 2012. So A&E seems to have a fascination with law enforcement personnel in Philadelphia. So we'll look for that show seemingly next year, though you never know. These things can get canned at the last second. You used to work in TV, so you never really know.
You never really know.
But we'll look for that. Story number three, Kevin, to lighten the mood, go ahead.
Yeah, well, everybody knows to be successful online, you need a thing, Avi, like a shtick, a hook, right?
You got to have a shtick.
Well, one French musician found his, and it's playing a pink classical guitar in a beautiful outdoor location and singing to an audience of animals.
And white horses couldn't drag me away.
All right, that's the artist known as Plumes on social media singing wild horses while being nuzzled by what seems to be a domesticated horse.
So
cute.
And
now I scanned his social media and there's all sorts of these videos with animals. He's an internet hit. Even former President Barack Obama was talking about how much he likes Plumes.
I understand. It's very appealing content.
But unfortunately, Avi, I would say not all his vids are as matchy-matchy with the animal and the song as maybe I would like to see. They're singing to seals, but there's no Kiss by a Rose by Seal.
Yeah, the truth is there's so many songs about animals you could do that. There's so many songs just about horses. You could do like 20 to 30 songs just about horses.
Yeah. There's monkeys, but there's no pixies. This monkey's going to heaven.
I don't even know that song, but I agree with your point.
There's lions, but the lion sleeps tonight.
Well, are you sure he's not done that?
I've scanned, Avi. I can't say I've exhaustively scanned, but I'm pretty sure.
Plumes.
But here's the news, Plumes.
Reach out to us if you're being slandered right now. Just putting that out there. Go ahead.
The news hook here is that Plumes is coming to our region next week to perform for animals at the Philadelphia Zoo. And maybe, just maybe, we'll get a Rocky III reference with some Eye of the Tiger.
That'd be great.
For the tigers at the Philadelphia Zoo. If you want to catch that, the zoo is offering some intimate performance sessions with Plumes next Thursday and Friday for $125. Nice write-up, by the way, by the Philadelphia Magazine. And Plume says it all started, Avi, when he was playing guitar on his grandmother's farm to cows in the French countryside. He also stresses that it's all about the music. He doesn't use food to lure the animals to him.
Well, that's what's amazing about the videos. The animals often come up to him, and it does, you know, it makes you think, like we say, music is the universal language, but just how universal are we talking here? Maybe animals seem to have a relationship with music. It definitely raises that possibility.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. And I will say, he is remarkably, like, steady.
Mm.
Like, the animals come up to him, and he's playing guitar, and it's like, I mean, I'd be freaking out. I mean, not that a horse is a dangerous animal. I'm just saying, I don't know how he focuses through it.
Well,
he's
there was one with a tiger. Tiger was walking right up to him. So,
no.
Yes, yes.
Dang, Plumes. Okay, well, come on the show, Plumes. Tell us how you do it. Also, stick with us. We're talking about robots coming up. Would love to hear your thoughts. 888-477-9499. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman. Errant Cherry Gregg is off today. When you think of a robot, what do you imagine?
I may be homely, Buster, but I'm S-M-A-R-T smart.
Go that way. You'll be malfunctioning within a day, you nearsighted scrap pile.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
I'll be back.
That's Rosie, the robot made from the Jetsons, C-3PO from Star Wars, Hal from 2001 A Space Odyssey, and of course, Arnold Schwarzenegger as the terrifying T-800 from The Terminator. In other words, we have very different visions of what a robotic future will look like, a lot of them pretty frightening. And for a long time, the idea that robots would be part of our daily lives seemed like far-off science fiction, but we may be getting closer than you think. Tech companies are racing to build humanoid robots for factories and for consumers. Indeed, for $20,000, you can take Neo home, a 5'6" humanoid robot with two camera lenses for eyes. It's just one of a dozen robots that are coming to market soon, and many are also being developed for the workplace. But while Silicon Valley and China invest heavily in these robots, can they really live up to the hype? Neo still relies on a remote human operator, after all. And what safety and privacy issues do these machines raise? Is it time to start thinking about how we'll coexist with them, especially if they're built to walk, talk, and look like us? We'd love to hear from you this hour. Would you want a robot to help you do the chores? Are you excited about this idea of personal robots? Are you terrified? Do you have questions? Give us a call. 888-477-9499. Email studio2 at whyy.org. YouTube, Facebook, comment in the live chat. Let me first, however, introduce our two guests this hour. Vijay Kumar is a professor and dean of Penn Engineering. He's worked in robotics on autonomous ground and flying robots for 4 decades. Professor Kumar, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And let me also introduce Stephen Witt, author of The Thinking Machine. He writes about technology for The New Yorker. And in fact, his article, Are Humanoid Robots Ready to Be Deployed, is what sparked the idea for this hour. So thank you, Stephen, and welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
All right. I want to read this comment from David in Galloway, New Jersey, to start us off. You can think of many dystopian scenarios if these household robots somehow experienced a software glitch or were hacked by mischievous or evil agents. It's one thing if your data disappears or your screen goes all wacky, but if a presumably powerful machine were to run amok in your apartment, things could get mighty dangerous. So let's start there, Stephen Witt, because, you know, you wrote this article for The New Yorker. And a lot of it was based around this new product, this new robot called Neo. And you're a jaded, you know, technology reporter. You say that in the article, and yet you were quite impressed by Neo. So first, who makes Neo and what makes it impressive to you?
Neo is made by a company called 1X in Silicon Valley. The CEO and founder is a guy named Bernt Bornich. He's Norwegian. He's actually been making robots for more than a decade. You know, I looked at a lot of robots for this article, and most of them were clunky and loud, and you just didn't want them in your house. What makes Neo so special is it's just an exquisite piece of engineering.
Hmm.
It's soft. It's quiet. You want to give it a hug. And that's on purpose. Bernt noticed that robots scared people. So he asked his designer to make a robot that didn't scare people, and in particular didn't scare children. Their first iteration scared everyone. Their second, adults were comfortable, but children under 12 were still scared. And they kept going with this until they created this robot with a very teddy bear-like a kind of appearance that actually wears clothing, and it's soft, and it's very lightweight. It weighs about 60 pounds. You can pick it up. So it's non-threatening, and it seems safe, addressing exactly the concerns that this reader has. Now, it's important to note that we've deployed a lot of robots already. Waymo is a robot, right? Mm-hmm. A kind of self-driving car is, in a sense, a robot. Yep. Yeah, and that can be hacked, right? And that has privacy concerns. So already we're being forced to deal with these issues and come to terms with the risks of these things, whether or not we deploy humanoids or not.
So in terms of capabilities, what makes Neo different? Or is Neo not that advanced at all? Like, what, this thing is going to start being deployed, shipped out to people, we think, this year. And people are paying quite a bit of money for it. So what can it actually do?
You know, not that much.
Not that much. Not, I mean, that, I mean, 20,000 bucks for not that much, anyway. Stephen Witt?
It can get you a glass of water, maybe. What's happening is that its front end is a large language model like ChatGPT, and then it has to translate your commands, your voice commands and actions, voice commands and requests into physical action, and that's where it kind of falls apart. You know, it's non-deterministic, meaning sometimes if you ask it to get a glass of water, it'll take a different action than it did the last time you made an identical request. And so to backfill this, as you mentioned, they're kind of using remote teleoperation. When you really want Neo to do a more sophisticated task, like let's say you want it to bartend at your party, you'll throw it to an actual human who's running it like a marionette. And when that happens, its little earpiece will light up and you'll know that it's actually being remotely operated. That team, the teleoperators, they sit right next to the AI group at 1X. And so what's happening is all the data that comes in when you do these real world kind of marionette things is fed into the AI so it can learn from it. So the idea is that over time, you'll use less and less human operators and more AI, if you're comfortable with that.
So it's collecting data, Professor Kumar. That's what it's doing right now. Basically, we're deploying data collection agents into people's homes. Am I understanding this correctly?
And that's pretty much what happened with Tesla and Waymo. They used us to collect data, and then they refined it through simulation and other tools. But the challenge is, as Stephen pointed out, is collecting internet scale data. With language, it was easy. Language and text, easier, I would say. But again, it's people like you and me that write things on the internet, and that's what these models are trained on. And now the question is, can we train robots to do useful things like pick up a glass of water? For that, you need lots of data.
Yeah, and there's a bit of a paradox, I think, at the center of this, which is that picking up a glass of water for a human, extremely easy task. My 3-year-old daughter can do it. She did it today. Driving a car, on the other hand, kind of a complex task to a human, right? In fact, we don't let people do it until they're at least 16 years old in our society. There's a lot that goes into it. Humans really aren't that great at it in many ways. And yet, in sort of our automated present, it's easier somehow to create an automated car than it is to create something that can pick up a glass of water. From a robotics engineering perspective, Professor, can you explain to us why that is?
Well, firstly, I might disagree slightly
with the
characterization of the driving task as being more complicated. The reason it's complicated is because we drive fast. Mm-hmm. There are lives at stake. But here technology comes to the rescue. Sensors today are superhuman. I claim that self-driving cars are far superior than what I can do in terms of reaction time, braking, and so on, and recognizing scenes in a way that humans sometimes cannot do.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem of driving a car, the reason it's simpler is because you're roughly a 2- or 3-dimensional world, and your job is to go from point A to point B and avoid things, as opposed to picking up objects where your goal is to contact objects. You don't want to avoid...
Avoiding objects versus contacting objects. From an engineering perspective, this is a huge difference.
And that is a huge difference. I want you to think of yourself as a robot. So wear, steel gloves without any sensation.
Yeah.
And imagine you're looking at this with sort of a lens that's somewhat distorted. And that's what today's robots have to deal with.
Right.
They don't have the right hands, the right end effectors. They don't have the right sensors. And they have to perform a task that humans have evolved to be uniquely good at.
Right. Which we didn't evolve to be uniquely good at driving cars, but we did evolve to be uniquely good at picking things up. And Stephen Witt, I wanted to talk, because we'll talk about how close we are to robots being useful in our homes in a second. But I think it's also worth, again, focusing on why this is a hard engineering challenge to begin with. And you wrote a lot about one of the toughest tasks here is simulating the human hand. If you've got a hand, it feels very easy to use, but it's very, very difficult to simulate in a machine setting, it seems. Has Neo made any sort of breakthrough there, and why is it so hard?
They rolled out a new hand right after I wrote the article, but they would not let me see it. So I will say the hands that they had on display were pretty impressive. I mean, Neo actually uses sort of uniquely a tendon system that's really based on kind of biomimicry. So most robot hands are just going to run on motors. Neo had these like fine cords where it was almost attached to a muscle, and as you pulled the muscle, the finger went up and down. But it's just as Vijay says, it's quite hard. You don't have the sensory feedback. Think about your fingertips and how many nerves are there. You know, the robot doesn't quite have something like that. You know, if I ask you or teach you, let's say, to shuffle a deck of cards, a kind of complex human action with a hand, you're going to get there in a couple, maybe 2 or 3 hours. You can probably figure it out. For a robot, it would take tens of thousands of hours of training data to get there, if it could get there at all. Now, the flip side of that is that the robot can be given tens and thousands of hours of training data, or in a physical simulator, millions, billions of hours if we need it to. So these things learn much more slowly than humans, but the flip side is we can just pump much more, training data through them.
Yeah. We have a comment and a call that are kind of similar to each other. I want to bring in this caller from Declan. This is Declan from New Jersey. And by the way, our number is 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. Declan from New Jersey, you have a thought, maybe a concern about our robotic future. Go ahead. You're on Studio 2.
Yes. So my concern is, could this worsen inequality in some ways? Because now rich people get $100,000 personal servants, possibly servants in factories who can do jobs, which now they just don't have to do. Could this basically be kind of some sort of inequality worsener that would make possibly fewer factory jobs exist, or just make it so that rich people live utterly comfortable lives surrounded by robotic servants?
Fantastic question, Declan. Yeah, go ahead.
I also think that it would be really cool to have a robot servant.
That's the two sides of the coin. Great call from Declan in New Jersey. Let's talk about the potential impact of this, because we're going to skip maybe past the how close we are to this reality conversation for a second and think about the societal impact. And Stephen Witt, I want to start with you. Declan is worried about job replacement. Is that inevitable here?
Yeah, it's 100% inevitable. And in fact, the explicit goal of the more industrial humanoid manufacturers like Elon Musk, a capable humanoid robot makes actual human beings less economically valuable, right? And I don't think our society has yet kind of tackled the ramifications of what that's going to mean. Large categories of jobs will disappear. Now, this happened in the last industrial revolution as well, and there was a lot of upheaval, but ultimately, it did end up producing a more prosperous society. But this is different than that in a sense, because it just means that there's not going to be that much that's obvious for humans to do. And so some of the AI companies are proposing things like, well, we just have to give equity stakes. We have to give stock in our companies to every American, or else there'll be some kind of populist revolt as the jobs go away. But the flip side of that is, as Declan pointed out, is that, it's great. What if we never had to clean a toilet again?
Right.
What, that's the drudgery goes away.
That's the promise. I've watched the promotional materials for Neo. And you mentioned the founder, very charismatic guy. He's got a nice Nordic accent. And he says the pitch here is that we're going to free up humans to do the things that humans actually enjoy doing. They're not going to have to do drudgery anymore. I am curious, Stephen, do you buy that? Do you buy that we're actually close to that future, or as close as the company says?
What we're missing here is data, right? There's not enough kind of data on physical action there's no internet of moving your hands around, right? So the ChatGPT and stuff trained on vast walls of text from the internet. There's no equivalent to that. So it's a slower process to learn. Now, we might make a breakthrough where we learn more quickly from this data, or we might just generate more data by putting people in motion capture suits and getting it from video. I would say the scenario that we're talking about here, if I had to guess, is somewhere between 3 to 5 years away. Like, like not tomorrow, but not that far away. Mm. And the other thing that has happened, I must say, I write about AI all the time, and I'm very optimistic about AI. And even so, I have underrated the pace of progress of AI. It is extraordinary how fast it moves. So it could happen even sooner. It might come out of nowhere.
And let me read this comment from Elise, who says, I think that having a robot in the house to help with household chores is this generation's improvement upon the invention of the washing machine, the dishwashers. It takes those tasks that are labor intensive and makes them easier so that we have time for other activities. So Elise sounds a little bit like a techno optimist there. We'd love your thoughts. 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org. Vijay, what do you see as the timeline here? And let's look at maybe two timelines here. One is the timeline for having these robots in our house that do domestic tasks. The other timeline is robots who simulate some level of factory work that isn't already mechanized. Are those two very different timelines in your mind, and what do they look like?
I think we underestimate the rate of progress. I mean, yes, it's true. We have more impressive demos. We have, as Stephen pointed out, a lot more opportunity to collect data. But if you look at the self-driving car industry, which actually continues to amaze me at the progress they've made, I just want to remind you the first self-driving car was built in 1988. And all this promise was there back then. Mm. And of course, you might say this time it's different because we have all the data, the internet scale data now with self-driving cars and so on. But to collect that data took a long time.
Yep.
And it took a lot of investment. And again, I would congratulate folks like Elon Musk, who said, we're going to record every mile that every human being drives and then build on that. Now, thinking about that process for robotic systems more generally, I think it's just a lot more complicated.
So it sounds like you're saying you think it's going to be a little bit
it's going
longer.
To be a lot longer. So, I mean,
For the factory? Because what Declan, our caller, pointed out was job replacement in factories. And for a factory robot, and we should be clear, there already are robotics in factories, robotic arms doing all sorts of things for car manufacturing, for instance. But what we're talking about now is expanding upon that. And those robots are doing maybe a very specific task or a narrower locus of task. And also, they don't have to look pretty.
No.
So is that a quicker process potentially?
It definitely is. So I'll give you an example. Yeah. One of my early startups, which went public back in May, manufactures autonomous drones. They work underground in mines in dark, dusty, dangerous
yes.
environments. No human being wants to do that. And they operate with the kind of 24/7 precision that we expect in machines. So is that displacing a job? Maybe. But it's the job we don't want in the first place. The question you have to ask is self-driving cars the similar nature? I don't believe so. But it's going to take a lot of time and make economic sense before that happens. The question you bring up about, there are humanoids that are deployed in shop floors. I think BMW, Mercedes is pushing that. One of the startups in the U.S., which I really like, is Agility Robotics. They're trying to do the same thing. There are demonstrations at this point. But if you look at those videos, you're exposed to the truth. These are painfully slow.
Mm.
I don't know, opposite of dexterous, I don't know what that word is, but clumsy.
Or stiff.
Stiff, clumsy. Clumsy, thank you.
We've got the writer and the professor here. This is the perfect combination.
Right. So I think Steve and I can debate this after a couple of drinks. Maybe we'll agree on the timeline. But I have some skepticism as to how quickly this will happen.
Where do you think they'll deploy first? Because if I can imagine there are some places in a factory where being slow and clumsy doesn't matter as much, especially, like you mentioned, replacing a job that is inherently dangerous to humans.
I'll give you a great example. Yeah. What's the most commonly sold robot today?
It's the Roomba? I don't know.
Yes. And I like to say nobody thinks of the Roomba because it truly sucks. By the way, sorry
good,
for that
good
joke.
Engineering pun.
sorry for that joke. But Roomba went out of business. It's a separate.
I got it.
So, but
robot vacuum.
There's 25 million vacuum cleaning robots that are being sold. Why? Because nobody wants to vacuum clean.
Right.
Right. So it makes sense.
It's does replacing it, something undesirable.
Exactly. Does it look like a robot? Does it look like a humanoid? Is it threatening? I don't know. It doesn't to me, but it might be collecting data. And Declan pointed out a bunch of things. Maybe there are maids that are being put out of business. So these are indeed realistic concerns. Yeah. But that ship has sailed. When we invented computers, we designed machines, we started collecting data. It's just going to progress. The question is, how quickly can it get to a point where it be truly disruptive?
Vlad from Norristown says, yesterday's show covered foreign hackers taking control of critical infrastructure. Imagine if they hacked humanoid robots in your home, the damage they could do. Sam from Wilmington also has some concerns. Hey, Sam, you're on Studio 2. It sounds like you have some skepticism or some concerns about humanoid robots in our built environment. You're on Studio 2. What are your concerns?
Hi there. Yeah, thanks for having me. I mean, in a world where we already have, you know, like Alexa devices and listening to us and flock cameras in the roads, like, I guess, how concerned do we need to be about letting these robots into our homes and how much data are they collecting on us? You know, like, are we being surveilled at all times? Should we, I don't know. It's a big concern that I have these days.
Yeah, that's a fair question. I want Stephen Witt to take a crack at those two concerns both of our commenters brought up. One is the idea that these could be hacked and manipulated by someone who shouldn't be. The other is basically what they're built to do, which is watch us and evaluate data. And how do we know that's being done safely in a way that protects our privacy? So could you take on both of those, Stephen Witt?
Yeah, I mean, these are huge concerns. Remember, the first one regarding hacking is already true of a self-driving car, right? A hacker can take control of your self-driving car and crash it into a building, right? That could happen. You know, with the robot, the way that they safeguard it, at least for the home robots, is they make it physically very weak, right? Like Neo can lift like 15 pounds total. And that's on purpose. It's deliberately made to be quite weak. So even if it malfunctions, it just can't do that much damage, really.
Did I also read that Neo is not supposed to pick up sharp things and maybe not try to manipulate things that are hot? Does it have those guardrails
there are
too?
So many outside of hacking, and this is the thing that I think doesn't get discussed enough. What if you just gave Neo a malicious command?
Right.
What if you were like, Neo, walk off the deck, go through the window, throw something? What would it do? Well, initially, it would probably decline because the LLM has guardrails. But people have shown that actually LLM guardrails, like AI guardrails, are quite easily jailbroken. So you may actually personally just be able to hack Neo by giving it kind of malicious commands, right? And this is also true of industrial robots, which makes them quite dangerous in a certain way. I think there's a whole safety aspect here. And this was something all of the roboticists who didn't work at 1X kept talking about with me. They were sort of stunned that 1X was even proposing to ship these into people's homes for exactly this reason. 1X pushed back that, you know, the robot's soft, it can't hurt anyone. But even a 60-pound robot can do a fair amount of damage, right? Particularly if it falls on a dog or knocks over a glass or you know, whatever it might be.
Yeah, so I mean, this sounds extremely concerning. I mean, you're saying, and what you're saying about the LLMs, the AI at the heart of all this, it doesn't sound like there's an easy fix for that.
No, there's none, right? I mean, this is the thing about modern AI. You build these kind of incredible systems. They're so capable. It's unbelievable. But you have really no idea what they can actually do or even how they actually work. It's a black box. It can be a real mystery. And then going to the second concern, the privacy concerns, look, Neo 1X, I should say, is very forthright that the robot's going to have cameras in your home. They make sure you are aware of that as a customer and that you're on board with that. I talked to some customers. These are people who put down deposits on a robot that should ship later this year, and they were all cool with it. You know, one guy told me, well, you know, if I just, you know, contacted a maid service, they'd put a stranger in my house to clean it. So I'm actually more comfortable with a remote teller operator in my house or a robot with cameras than I am physically with an actual person I've ever met before.
But you're making a clear trade-off. You're making a clear trade-off. I mean,
you're making a trade-off. I think a lot of people will be uncomfortable with that. I think the majority of people will not want that. But there's a certain kind of person who just wants a robot in their house so badly. And I talked to a lot of them, and they could not wait for these things to arrive.
Interesting.
They just watched the Jetsons as a kid. They watched Star Wars, whatever it was, and they were just, even as kids, and it always went back to media they'd consume when they were young, fixated on it and just had to have it as soon as possible. So I think initially 1X is targeting that kind of customer. And then over time, we'll see if it can't expand to a larger group.
Yeah, the more skeptical folks, like myself. We want to hear from you. Would you want a robot to help to do chores at home? Are you excited? Are you terrified about this idea? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org, and we'll be right back. And welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Cherry Gregg is off today. We are continuing our discussion about robots. Tech companies are racing to build humanoid robotic companions for our everyday needs. But can they live up to the hype? And our question again today, would you want a robot to help do chores at home? Are you excited about the idea of personal robots? Are you terrified? 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. YouTube, Facebook, comment in the live chat. And let me reintroduce our guest. Vijay Kumar is a professor and dean of Penn Engineering. He's worked in robotics on autonomous ground and flying robots for 4 decades. And Stephen Witt is author of The Thinking Machine. He writes about technology for The New Yorker. Vijay, I wanted to get your thoughts on this safety question because I can't help but feel like we are Icarus flying toward the sun here and our wings are going to melt off at some point, that we're just barreling towards some sort of catastrophic outcome. How do you think about safety when it comes to these robots that live in the world?
So I agree. All the dystopian things we can imagine, the thing I worry most about is safety. When we build a machine, it's our moral responsibility to make sure it's safe. But safety is a funny property. So if you go and ask a roboticist or a consumer in China versus somebody in the US, their notions of safety are very different. And in fact, safety is very contextual. And I think that's the one thing AI is good at. And I'll give you the example of 2 cars rushing to each other towards each other at 55 miles an hour each. And if they're on different lanes with a divider, our perception of safety is very different than if there's no divider, right? Mm-hmm. So it has to depend on the scene. It has to depend on the context. And that's where I think AI can do a better job of safety than currently car manufacturers can do. Same thing with humanoids. So of all the things we worry about, I worry most about safety at the software level, interacting with the hardware. And, you know, one of the top companies in this area that worries about safety is Fort Robotics in Washington.
Right here in Philadelphia.
Yeah, right here.
What is the scenario that keeps you up at night, though, when it comes to humanoid robots? Let's just look at that, because we could talk about AI in general, but, you know, you're someone that works deeply with this technology, has thought about it for a long time. Is there a scenario that, I don't know, scares you the most?
I think humanoids are unsafe. I think Stephen just pointed this out. You know, it doesn't matter if it weighs 15 pounds or carries 30 pounds or 10 pounds. They are not balanced. They have to actively balance themselves. Anytime you have a machine like that, I would not let that machine into my house. Plain and simple.
Yeah, what would you need to see before you had the faith to let it into your house?
Oh, it's interesting. Most robots like that are not, there's no federal organization that says these are the safety guidelines.
Yep.
So as a user, I would need to establish trust. And that's why we let washing machines inside our house. We trust them. You turn the machine on, they wash, and it's not going to go after chasing your cat or anything like that. You know, you have a model of how that machine behaves. We don't yet have a model of how humanoids can behave, except through these videos, which are carefully scripted, designed to impress you, and then they pay a lot of attention to the aesthetics. So I don't think we're at a position that we can say, well, this is safe and this is not safe.
Let me read this comment from Farmer Matt, who's one of our regulars. The robotic future gets really interesting when you look at agriculture. A lot of farming can absolutely be automated, but some of the work we rely on migrant and low-wage labor for is incredibly difficult to replicate with machines. Try building a robot that can identify a perfectly ripe strawberry, pick it without bruising it, and move on to the next one. Then do the same with tomatoes, peaches, flowers, and dozens of other crops. I think agriculture raises an interesting question about the robotic future. What happens when we automate everything that's predictable, but reach the jobs that require judgment, dexterity, and adaptability? I would love to get your thoughts on Farmer Matt's comment, Stephen Witt. I guess he's bringing up this idea that maybe could we penetrate that deeply, where even the jobs that seem very difficult to automate are going to be
100%.
Automated.
We're 50%. I mean, in terms of identifying and targeting ripe fruit, for example, so Amazon has, when they bring the strawberries down a conveyor belt, they just have an AI watching it. and they can identify within nanoseconds which ones are good and which ones are bad. Machines, in terms of identification of ripe fruit and what's going to be good to pick or not, have been superhuman for years already, right? So then it's just a question of, well, can you pick the fruit without bruising it? They are not superhuman right now. In fact, they're not very good at it because it just requires those really fine motor skills to get in there and pick it right without crushing it, right? It's actually quite a nice thing that we can do that with our fingers. It's a pinnacle of human evolution, I would say. Having said that, you know, I'm more optimistic than Vijay about this, and readers can take this with a grain of salt, but I recall using GPT-2 and GPT even 3 back in 20 and 2021, and I'm a writer, and I was like, oh, these things are terrible. These are toys. They'll never catch up to us. 3 years later, it's as good as I am or better, you know, 3 years. I mean, ChatGPT is not even 4 years old, right?
I think it's the
progress
question,
here is just insane, and that can happen with fingers too.
Right, right. Yeah, right. And I want to bring in some calls. You have a lot of folks waiting, so I'll put my question to the side for a second. Jim from Parkersburg, Pennsylvania is on the line. Hey, Jim, you have a question about robots, humanoid robots. What is it?
Yeah, and you know, just to explain my background, I have a long history in high technology, information technology, cybersecurity, and large language models. So, you know, what I'm looking at is how these possibly integrate into a home or residential setting. You know, and I can think of benefits for, you know, senior care and things like that. But the AI component in terms of companionship, it both brings interest, but it also can be very scary depending on the, you know, the background of that AI.
Yeah. And that's something that's sort of already playing out, right, with chatbots being used for some level of companionship, human interaction, social, emotional gratification. Do you have thoughts on that, Vijay? And I wonder, because it gets to the question really of why are we even building humanoid robots? If you build something with humanoid features, does it deepen or expand the possibility of robots as companions because we just naturally look at them and connect with them more?
Yeah, absolutely. I think studies have shown, so for example, robots can help kids with autism, and that's because they look attractive. They can be made to look attractive and interesting. So yes, that's a humanoid with just a face,
right?
Without all the things that I'm worried about. So I would 100% agree that's a great opportunity. Also in the agriculture space, as we were discussing earlier, that's a problem that needs to be solved, particularly in the United States.
Mm. Let's bring in another caller. This is Bob from Doylestown on the line. Hey, Bob, you're on Studio 2. Questions, concerns about robots? Go ahead. Bob, are you with us? I'm not picking up Bob. Let's move on to Lorraine now from Philadelphia, who has a question. Lorraine's on line 3. Lorraine, you have a question about robots, how they work. What is it?
Yeah, it's based on maintenance. A while ago, WHYY had a woman on who was a do-it-yourselfer, and she talked about how everything is so digital and computerized now, whereas when things were mechanical, she could fix them themselves. They had longer lifespans. So with all the electronics and all, I'm wondering about maintenance, lifespan of the robot. Are you going to have to do software updates? I have a vacuum cleaner and it doesn't work, but it's like, what, you know,
it's a good point
down on me.
Yep.
So do I, you know, I paid $600 for it. I mean, I have to get it fixed or do I buy a new one? So what's the reliability on it and what are the maintenance requirements going to be as far and the lifespan?
That's where you get into taking these things to mass market. Reliability, resilience, Vijay, your thoughts on how close we are, because I think that's how you start to cross the divide from these are being bought by tech enthusiasts to these are being bought by everyday people who rely on them. Your thoughts?
At a very crude high level, you can say, is the software reliable and is the hardware reliable? And I think the software, the advantage is you can patch it, right? And Lorraine's exactly right. On the hardware side, it's a lot more complicated. But robots are even worse because it's about the software-hardware interface. Yep. Oftentimes, the hardware is perfect, the software is perfect, but the two things interact in ways resulting in failure modes that you don't predict.
Yeah.
So Lorraine is absolutely right. It's going to be a nightmare.
It's a big hurdle. Yeah. Do you agree, Stephen? Is that one of the big hurdles out there?
Oh, for sure. These things can and do break. They are – well, think if you think about an automobile, if you think about the amount of engineering, how long it took you know, Six Sigma manufacturing, all that stuff that was developed over decades to make a truly reliable car. Robots are in like year two of that, right? Like they're very much like early automobiles where they just break all the time. Both hardware malfunctions and software malfunctions. You know, I think the customers who I talked to were expecting that. They very much did not expect a perfectly polished finished product. They knew they were early adopters and they knew that things were going to go haywire. Now, in terms of replacing it and fixing it yourself, it's funny. Neo is, it seemed to me very much to be a closed platform. It's very much like Apple's iPhone. It breaks, you tape recalling a technician or you don't go get another one. You don't go into the guts of the machine. However, Unitree, the Chinese firm, distributes the G1 robot. And that one really has almost an open source brain. You can kind of go into its programming. You can see what it's doing. I think if you had some mechanical or hardware background, you could, in fact, unscrew it and replace its parts. Mm. So that's more like the Android platform.
It's almost modular. Interesting.
Huh. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it depends. I think actually the majority of people who buy their robots won't want to fix them.
Right.
I think they'll want them just to work.
Yeah.
That would be my guess based on past consumer trends.
And that, you know, if we had hour two, we would talk about the China versus US dynamic and all this. It does seem like China is ahead in some ways, including supply chains, but we're going to have to table that conversation for another day because we do have a lot of commenters that are just worried about the societal impact of all this. Jan from Upper Gwynedd, the divide between the haves and the have-nots widens again in real time. Once again, the 1% disenfranchises the rest of us. Julie from Philly says, I wish we could broaden this conversation to think about what our ultimate goals are with AI and data collection and robots imitating humans. We need a broader conversation to think about human relationships and labor. Look, we only have a couple minutes left, but we have to, neither of you are political philosophers, but we have to speak this anxiety people have about how society will be fundamentally reshaped if all of this does play out and what the heck we should do about it. Because a lot of people are going to say, look, Vijay, let's just stop this at the gate. It's not worth the risk. What do you say?
Absolutely. And so you have to weigh the positives versus the negatives. And the negatives that are being pointed out are very, very real. But I would just say, if you look at the biggest robotics company in the US, it's Intuitive Systems. They're surgical robots. Mm. So then you have to ask, well, is that worth it? And do they do more good than bad? And I think they do. Can they be hacked? Are they certifiably safe? Well, the FDA is regulating it, so I think they're safe. So there are those kinds of applications that I wouldn't want to give up because
baby
of
with
the worry.
Bath water.
Yeah. Yeah, because of the worry of the divide. Yes, there might be a divide, but at this point, it's not there. I'd be more worried about AI putting, you know, decreasing the number of jobs at the mid-level. That would be my bigger worry.
Interesting. Stephen, your thoughts about this, these sort of broader societal concerns, the way that this could make disenfranchise people, make them feel rootless, make them feel like they don't have purpose, widen the gaps between the rich and the poor. You must think about this stuff. I'm sure people in Silicon Valley talk about it. What are your general thoughts?
AI is having a transformative year. It's just going insane what they've been doing. I mean, they've been proving and resolving long-standing open mathematics problems. We have all sorts of progress in LLMs, everything. I mean, I use it constantly, and it's useful. What's interesting is in the first 6 months of this year, the U.S. GDP growth was a puny 1.5% as this revolution is going on. So that suggests to me that a large range of economic activity is actually being cannibalized by AI, and it's not necessarily contributing to growth. And as your caller points out, almost all of the benefits are accruing to a very narrow section of society, essentially like a few hundred thousand highly skilled tech and finance people, and no one else is really getting any money from it. So that creates really dangerous political conditions when that happens, right? You have a bunch of disenfranchised people losing their jobs, and it's not clear what's going to happen. I think the proposal to just give American stock in these companies is an interesting one. It kind of is sloppulist almost, like Trump proposed it, but maybe Bernie Sanders would be into it too. Like, you could see how it could maybe have a bipartisan support. I actually like that proposal. I know it sounds insane, but what if you just got some stock in Anthropic?
It's just, you know, right? It's just insane enough to make me think perhaps there's a show to come on that topic. We do have to end this show, however, right now. That's Stephen Witt, author of The Thinking Machine. He writes about technology for The New Yorker. Stephen, thank you so much for being with us on Studio 2.
Thank you for having me.
And Vijay Kumar, Professor and Dean of Penn Engineering, thank you for being here on stage.
Thanks for a great conversation.
I really did enjoy it. And I do have to say, before we get to DJ of the Day, a bit of a personal note. This is going to be my last show for a while. I am taking some family leave for a couple months. You can probably guess what that's about. I'll be back in October. I leave you in the very capable hands of Cherry Gregg and the rest of our team, and I look forward to rejoining you in October. Now it's time to reveal our Studio 2 DJ of the Day song selection. Al, hit it.
They're programmed to destroy us.
Oh, wow. Getting fancy with it. That's a mashup of Robot by the Alan Parsons Project from 1977 and Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots Part 1 by the Flaming Lips from 2002. Thank you to Joe B., Julia W., Michael G., and Karen S. for writing in and being our co-DJs of the day. Our show is produced by Debbie Builder, Hazel Mae Bryan, and Ben Abrams. Al Banks and Mike Schiffler engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. Thank you for joining us. But you